Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website, kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, so very special. It's safe to say that we live in one of the most physically beautiful places in the country. We have the majestic mountains capped with snow. We have the constantly changing sea, and we even have bald eagles soaring overhead most of the year. Many people come for a brief visit and fall in love with the place. And that raises an interesting question. At what point is someone deemed a local? Okay, there's a cohort that were actually born here and never left. But let's face it, they're outnumbered by so-called outsiders who now call the Olympic Peninsula home. What's the cutoff date? Do you have to live here a decade to be a local? Or perhaps it's 20 years? Maybe it's 40 years. Is that long enough for everyone to agree it's definitely a local? I raise the issue because today's guest is someone who everyone would probably agree is the epitome of a local girl. But horrors, she actually sailed into Port Townsend back in 1973. That means she's only been here a mere 49 years. Does she count as a local? But now that her secret's out, I would like to welcome Carol Hasse to the show. Carol's currently a commissioner for the Port of Port Townsend. But many people know her for her sailmaking business, the Sail Loft, or perhaps for her endless community activism. But let's get the backstory. So, Carol, you weren't born on the Olympic Peninsula. Where did you get started?
Well, thank you, Marianne, for this opportunity to share a little bit about my life and for all you do for the community. I was raised up in Camas, Washington, which is a stinky little mill town, beautifully sited, about the same size as Port Townsend was during the time I grew up, and also the same size as Port Townsend is now. It's right on the banks of the Columbia River. It was a beautiful place. It was a lovely town to grow up in. And it had the same paper mill that Camas did, under ownership of Crown Zellerbach.
So what did your folks do?
Well, my father worked in the paper mill in the payroll department. He was also the president of our local credit union, was a city council person for a while, and had a small accounting business. He did some work on the side, including he gave his time to do the books for our local Methodist church. And my mom was, for a while, worked in the bank and also at the mill, but her passion and the thing that she did that she loved the most in her work was, along with a friend of hers who had a developmentally disabled child, got a grant, took over the Camas retired city hall when the new one was built, and that retired city hall became the classrooms and the fire hall, the playground for several developmentally disabled people in our community. And when I was growing up, developmentally disabled children went to a state school.
Right.
They weren't integrated as they are now in our public school system.
It's true. So are you an only child?
No, I am the oldest of four.
Okay.
And we all came one after the other.
Yep. Okay. And in your household, were you four encouraged or expected to go on to college?
Yes, we were. My mom packed me up my first day of first grade. We didn't have kindergarten back there. Told me I had to get straight A's so I could get a scholarship, go to college, which I obeyed and did.
Good for you. And so where'd you end up going?
Well, I went to the University of Puget Sound in 1969 after I graduated from high school, but I didn't stay very long. I got very involved in protesting the Vietnam War and believing that activism could lead to not just the end of war, but the end of hunger and the end of poverty, and was disillusioned enough by our nation's actions to decide that I should see the world and travel before I settled down and continued my education. So I dropped out after my first year of college.
And did you stay there to continue protesting, or did you go to a bigger city?
I actually, what should have been my sophomore year of college, took my summer earnings from the paper mill and took a charter flight from Vancouver, BC, over the pole, a prop plane, to London, and ended up hitchhiking through 23 countries at the age of 19. And I had a friend from high school who was going to go with me, but she decided that wasn't for her. So I did that on my own and learned a lot and saw a lot. And when I got to the border of Iraq and Syria, felt like, boy, there's no place like home, and especially our beautiful Pacific Northwest. Decided that Canada was probably the country for me. But in the meantime, when I hitchhiked home from New York to the state of Washington, I had a couple of goals in mind, and that was to not leave the Northwest until I'd climbed Mount Rainier and hiked the portion of the Crest Trail that goes through our state from the Bridge of the Gods to the Canadian border. Okay. So I did those things pretty quickly after I returned.
You told me the other day you had a bit of a warm-up act to that. You went to Berkeley and did things like saw hare and ate your first vegan restaurant. You didn't eat the restaurant. Yeah. The first vegan.
So one of the wonderful things about the University of Puget Sound, it was it had a semester in the fall and then what was called a winterim or intensive study period in the month of January and then a semester in the spring. And in the winterim, students had a choice if they could afford to go to Hawaii and study marine biology or Europe and study architecture. Or what I did was study comparative religion by getting in Charlie Morton of Morton Salt school bus and driving down to the Bay Area. And we camped out, all of us students, in the upstairs of the Methodist Church. And we went to, we saw Sufi dancing. We ate in that vegetarian restaurant, which was so thrilling for me. I've actually been a vegetarian since that time. And we went to Stanford and saw the big satellite dish that turns out has only heard from outer space one thing, and that's the word om, or the vibration om. Anyway, it was just an opportunity for me to expand my spiritual awareness and right. my seeing other opportunities in the world.
And so then you went to Europe and explored. How yes. many countries did you say?
23. Wow, that's hitchhiked through 23 countries, yeah.
And fortunately, you made it through without any major bad incidents.
Fortunately, I did. And my mother and father were very happy when I returned home.
Yes, I would imagine that's true.
As was the wife of our family doctor, Dory Brooking, and she had 8 children. Her daughter, Lindy, lives here. She's a brilliant counselor. But anyway, Dory was the only grown-up who'd encouraged me to go ahead and abandon my full tuition scholarship and see the world. And she and her husband were having a Cascade 42 built on their riverfront property outside of Camas. And I became friends with the boat-building family and was invited to do some offshore sailing with the Brooking family. And I jumped at that chance because I'd always wanted to go to sea, to be on the water. And my career goal had been to become a doctor and work on the ship Hope, which was a thing then, a hospital ship mm-hmm. that went around the world. And I realized that I didn't actually really want to be a doctor. I was, turns out, afraid of the sight of blood.
Details.
Details. But I still wanted to go to sea and to have this opportunity to take off from my hometown and cruise down the west coast of North America and Baja and Mexico down to Costa Rica to learn celestial navigation and then begin crewing for other people who needed a navigator who had become my friends along the way.
Okay, so that's how you ended up making enough money to continue on, right?
No, I made all my money for those travels and adventures at the paper mill. I'd go back and plug in for a few months. What I got out of that was free passage, basically, and my food and the opportunity to spend 5 weeks in the Galapagos and 43 days at sea on a passage that from the South Pacific to the North Pacific, and just realized that the life at sea and the is so empowering and so humbling and beautiful, and I just wanted to be a part of that and discovered that that was where I thought I wanted to build my own boat mm-hmm. and have my own vessel and carry on with offshore cruising, as it's called, and seeing the world in that manner.
And how did you end up in Port Townsend?
Well, when I came back from that year at sea, I found a close friend from college involved in a communal boat building project in Bellingham. And the boat was a Skookum 47 Ketch, which was a bare fiberglass hull that had been built in Port Townsend, trucked up to Bellingham, and the commune members were high school or childhood friends from Mercer Island. And as soon as they realized they weren't going to be drafted into the Vietnam War, these four guys and their partners and friends decided, well, let's build a boat and go see the world. So I got involved with that. And so, my part of it was to help make the sails.
Okay. So there was a commune that was building the boat. And did you join that group?
Yes. Oh, yes. In a heartbeat. And they were the loveliest of people. They were so responsible and had so much integrity. And the boat was built. We're all still friends. The boat is still sailing. Every one of those people went on to lead a really remarkable life. And it's just a joy to have been associated with something that was ideal in its form, you know, that was so successful.
So you built the boat successfully, and did you sail it to Port Townsend?
We did. First, we sailed up into Desolation Sound and the beautiful fjords up in BC, which were equally beautiful to anything I'd seen in the South Pacific. And then we ended up joining another communal boat building project. The boat was named the Moclips, that had come up from Moclips, Washington, with a bunch of wonderful people from that part of the world, Two Point Hudson, and they gave us a call and said, hey, there's work down here. Come on down. And that was, we loaded all of our worldly possessions onto that boat and into one Volkswagen van, got ourselves down here with the idea that we would get to work and earn the money that we needed to go ahead and go cruising.
So how many were in the group at that point?
Well, there were eight, and then some family members and friends that would kind of come and go. And when we sailed into Point Hudson, I just fell in love. I thought it was the most charming little harbor marina that I'd ever seen, with all the evergreen forest beach on one side and this Victorian town on the other, and the mountains behind it, and the mountains being all around, and this sort of big opening that would take you out to the ocean. It's still, when I turn that corner into Point Hudson, is just lifts my heart. It's such a beautiful place.
So you had acquired the skill by then to make sails.
I had. I'd worked a bit in Seattle at the Shaw Tower Loft. The Franz Shaw Tower was a master sailmaker from Germany, and learned a very incredible type of sailmaking from him. Sails that were really specifically designed to go the distance, that were Cape Horn worthy, that were specifically for blue water cruising as opposed to round the buoys racing. And that was where my heart was. So I did know enough, I thought, about sailmaking to go ahead and start my own business. Because what I discovered when I got to Port Townsend was that I really did want my own boat. Not that I didn't want to be with those wonderful people on our communal boat, but I still had this dream of having my own boat. So I thought the only way I could do that was to go ahead and acquire to start a business. Mm-hmm. And that was inspired, of course, by 2 years, or a year previously, being involved with starting our Wooden Boat Festival with the friends that had come up from Moclips, Sam Connor and Jim Steffen, and a crew of wonderful people. There were a dozen or more of us who got that first Wooden Boat Festival off the ground and started the Wooden Boat Foundation, of which I was the secretary of the board.
So what year was the first Wooden Boat Festival?
I'm pretty sure the first Wooden Boat Festival was 77.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. And so, I started the business in 78 with a partner, Nora Petrich, who's a big part of KPTZ.
Right.
And Nora was the only friend I had who'd both made sails, which is the only way you can learn to make sails, is to go to work in a sail loft. And she'd worked in one in San Diego while I was working in one in Seattle, and had been offshore cruising and had that same love of open ocean sailing and the power of it. So I was pretty afraid to go into business. I'm not a business person. I was reluctant about that part, but I wanted to make sails. And of all the marine trades, it was the most exciting to me. Things I'd sanded, I'd varnished, I'd cut bungs. I'd run some power tools with great trepidation. I'd help lay up fiberglass hulls. And I realized sailmaking was the cleanest, the quietest, the healthiest in my mind. I got to go barefoot at work. I got to produce products that in a relatively short amount of time. It was just a beautiful, beautiful trade
well,
in every way.
Your business turned out to be quite successful over time.
It did. I was really lucky. I bought Nora out in 95, but all along I stayed involved with offshore passage making with friends periodically and got involved with sail training and representing at the boat shows and doing more and more public speaking and lecturing. I actually got to speak to the Annapolis Naval Academy a couple of times through work I was doing with U.S. Sailing and Safety at Sea as part of sail training. And it was those talks and that exposure that connected me with really remarkable inspirations like Nigel Calder and Lynn Pardee, who became friends and had that opportunity to, rather than market through advertising, which is a little bit of a crapshoot, I was able to directly market to people who might be interested in my sales through again, boat shows, cruising seminars,
So did
lecturing.
You at some point achieve your dream of getting your own boat?
I did. My own boat actually came within 6 months of starting the business. And I lived in the shop for 2.5 years. And
saved on rent.
Yeah, saved on rent. I didn't own a car at that time. And I didn't have a family or a pet or anything that, you know, and that was a great way to lower overhead. But in January of 79, this beautiful little folk boat sailed in. And I had done some sailing on a sister ship to a folk boat in the Hawaiian Islands, which is a really rough sea state. And I knew how strong those boats were and how well-found, how seaworthy. And it was 25 feet long. And I thought, well, this is a good size for me to start with. And I still have that boat.
So well, that's good.
It sailed into Point Hudson Harbor with a for sale sign on it. And I'm a believer that boats choose us. We don't choose them. And I went, oh, okay, this is my boat. So I got my dad to co-sign a loan and I still have that beautiful little folk boat, which I could take ocean sailing with some adaptation, but it's the perfect Salish Sea boat. So I've sailed all the way down to Olympia to visit Sam Devlin in South Sound and up north to Princess Louisa and Desolation Sound. So Lorraine has sailed the whole Salish Sea, and that's the best place
partners.
For her. And then I could go, you know, on trips from Mexico to the Marquesas or in Fiji and Tahiti and do those things in the line of sail training, which also generally brought business to the sail loft.
Well, in 2021, you decided to sell your business. Can you talk about why you made that decision at that point in time and who actually bought it?
Oh, I'd love to share about that. Well, I started my business when I was 27 years old, and as I love to say, if I were 27, I'd sign up for another 43 years, but I had sort of drawn a line in the sand for myself that at 70, I would try to sell the business, hopefully to my crew, and that I would then be able to retire and in a modest way, but write the book that I always wanted to write about sailmaking and paint and draw and garden and sail and spend more time on the water, all those things. Because when you turn 70, you realize there's a whole lot more time behind you than there is ahead of you, and it's time to choose wisely while one is still healthy and has interests in things. So I put the business on I announced it at the 2019 Wooden Boat Festival that the business was for sale. And of course, I'd talked to my employees at that time, and none of them were truly interested in becoming entrepreneurs, but they're such talented sailmakers.
How many employees did you have at that time?
At that time, just there were only 8 of us, but during the years that I had the business, there were as many as 13. Mm-hmm. But in my lifetime, sailmaking has been corporatized. What passes as a sail loft in Seattle or Vancouver, BC, or anywhere down the coast, is a place where you come and talk to a sail maker who may or may not have ever made a sail, but is a fantastic racer usually, and you order that sail, and then it's made in China Sail Factory, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, any number of places, Turkey, South Africa. And it's really taken the craft to a lower level, in my opinion, in terms of seaworthiness and in terms of the continuity of learning from one sailmaker to another. So I really felt strongly that we needed to maintain that skill in Port Townsend on our shores in North America, and I wanted my brilliant, talented sailmakers to be able to continue making sails, which they have a passion for, and so much skill. So,
you didn't
luckily,
want to sell out to a big corporation.
I did not want to sell out to a big corporation. And I was lucky to find a buyer in the Port Townsend Shipwrights Co-op. And while none of them are sailmakers, they saw the value of the business and the ability of the crew to carry it on, and that would not only keep this business on our working waterfront that's so essential to us, our community, but also give them another service and skill to offer their customers, because we did have a lot of mutual customers. Vessels, sailboats that they were building or repairing or rebuilding, they often were our customers too. So I'm so grateful. All of my sailmakers have jobs, and they're just doing a beautiful job. The Sail Loft has moved from its Point Hudson location that was so beautiful with all of its windows, port and starboard, and the old heritage building, and a sweet little spot to be under the roof of the Shipwrights Co-op. But it's pretty magical, the space that the Shipwrights Co-op has created with the input of the sailmakers, who are all women, to create a space that functions beautifully and works for them. And all of my sailmakers, most of them have boats themselves. They have now the opportunity to avail themselves of co-op tools and mentorship in that regard, and
that's handy.
It's just lovely. So
you decided at some point in time to run for port commissioner.
Yes, running for port commissioner.
Was that before or after you sold the business?
Well, it was after I sold the business. And Bill Putney, dear Bill Putney, who's a big part of KPTZ, was the port commissioner of District 2, which is the one that I live in. I live out on Discovery Bay. And he would come up to the Sail Loft during wooden boat festivals and tell me he wanted me to be his successor, and I would just roll my eyes and go, I don't think so. And I was really so busy, preoccupied, full-on, flat-out with the Sail Loft.
Right.
I had to make sure jobs were coming in the door and that I could get the boats measured and, you know, payroll. All that stuff had to happen. So I could go to port meetings and mouth off, but I didn't really have time to be a port commissioner. So when I realized that I had sold the business and I didn't have the kind of cash flow I'd had as a business owner, and that maybe it would be nice to have a little extra income, that was part of the decision. Port commissioners get a stipend for what they do.
How much do they get?
It's $285 a month plus health insurance, and then some extra for meetings that you attend. So and I felt like, you know, that might be a nice addition. Plus, I wanted to stay active in my community.
Right.
And I felt like, you know, I know all the players here. Maybe I could be a commissioner. And I had the blessing, again, of Bill. He was stepping down from his position, so I didn't have to run against an incumbent. I had his endorsement. And so I threw my hat in the ring, and then lucky me, nobody else did. So it enabled me to spend my summer on my retirement cruise, which was 2 months in my 25-foot wooden boat with various friends. And my son came at 26 and spent another week with me. Mom in the bucket, we called it. But anyway, the work of being a port commissioner is really engaging and compelling, and I get to be very actively involved in learning more about the environment through these various committees.
There are many things the Port Commission has to follow, control, whatever. What are the biggest issues right now?
Well, the biggest issues for our port are ensuring that we have generationally viable working waterfront, that we have this economic engine that's also the authenticity and the identity of our community, that it carries on, that we have maritime education at the core, that we can ensure that our marinas, Point Hudson, the Boat Haven and Quilsea remain open to the public, not privatized, not that our uplands aren't sold off to development such as condos and chain restaurants that don't represent our community, that we cherish and nurture this unique thing that we have in our community that's unique truly on both coasts, the level of talent and capability in our marine trades is just beyond measure. And if we were to suffer, God forbid, the big one, or just deal with climate change and the resiliency that we need to have as a community, we need people who can fix things and do things. That's true. And that's what our working waterfront represents in a big way. And so there's that. And of course, we have to prepare for climate change. We have to be a part of workforce housing solutions. We have to be a part of food resiliency. And one of the beautiful things, and one of the reasons I wanted to run, is that we now, first in our state, have an intergovernmental collaborative group, which is a meeting of the city council, the port commission, the county commission, and the PUD to sit down and talk about what these real concerns are, because Port Townsend is not immune to the global trauma that we're going through of climate change, of disparity between the rich and poor, between our concerns about food resiliency and potential disasters that are related to the weather or just to sea level rise. So those are solutions that we have to come together as the elected officials with the community's blessing and support to see how we can prepare ourselves for the future of our community and our children and our grandchildren.
Unfortunately, there does seem to be a basic agreement between the various groups about saving things. You know, we're really, really short on time, but I'm just going to ask you two quick things. One, do you have an estimate of how many people in Port Townsend are involved in the greater marine trades?
Oh, good question. Is there an estimate of how many people? Well, I can say that the marine trades and its ripple effects is responsible for 20 or more percent of the economy in our community.
Okay, because I'm not sure everyone who's not in the marine trades realizes that.
Yes.
Okay, last question. You mentioned you sailed into Port Townsend in 1973 and fell in love. Are you still in love?
Yes, I'm still in love. And actually, it was 1975.
Sorry.
1973 is when we launched our boat in Bellingham and took off to cruise the Northwest. Yes, I'm still very much in love. I'm in love with Point Hudson. This community, to me, has the highest per capita number of geniuses and craftspeople of renown who inspire me every day.
Anyway, Carol, thank you. We're officially out of time. I want to thank you for being a guest on the show. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Mary Ann McNellis. My guest today has been Carol Hasse, Commissioner for the Port of Port Townsend, and until last year, owner of the Sail Loft in Point Hudson. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend. I'm Mary Ann McNellis, signing off for today, but please keep listening to KPTZ for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Mary Ann McNellis and edited by Taylor Clark.